So I'm sitting here with Rick McDonnell from the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists, the second A being particularly important in ACAM's name, I think. You're here in Latvia for the first time, I understand, to set up a new chapter of ACAM's. Can you tell us exactly what the organization is and why now is the time to establish this?
Well, yes, thank you for the question and the time. ACAMS is a global body which has membership now around the world of about 58,000 compliance officers from financial institutions. Financial institutions have certain responsibilities under the law in many, many countries to ensure that anti-money laundering and terrorist financing rules are applied. And as a consequence, ACAMS provides training, certification, and information and networking opportunities for interaction between compliance officers. So the reason for ACAM's existence is to provide training and certification and expertise. The reason for setting up what we call chapters, which is basically just working groups of compliance officers from banks in any given place, is to assist in that role that they have. So I guess in simple terms, it means that there's a great opportunity for people who are in the same boat, same challenges, to meet and talk to each other, and at the same time provide external speakers with some experience in anti-money laundering to talk to them.
And did ACAMS have any sort of any presence here at all previous to this? Because if, with 58,000 people part of the organisation, it sounds like there must have been some sort of contact beforehand.
There was, not by me personally, but by other people in ACAMS. Yes, we had a good working relationship with the Bankers Association and with some of the government agencies, the regulator and the central bank. So it paved the way for ACAMS to come and begin a chapter. And the chapter is a Baltics chapter, so it'll be the three countries be co-joined into this chapter. So Lithuania and Estonia have had involvement, and we welcome them into this chapter, which will be launched tonight as well. So ACAMS has had interaction with Latvia over the last 6 months or so in regard to this establishing a chapter here. And I have to say, a very happy and eager bunch of people who want to join. We have, to my happy surprise, I say surprise because I'm new to Latvia, but it is drawing a lot of people, more than 100, I believe, yes. When in some other countries, the first chapter launch meeting would not have brought that many. That indicates some enthusiasm or at least interest in the subject.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say there is interest in the subject here. And in a sense, the timing couldn't have been better, where we have things like the Paradise Papers coming out and, you know, money laundering is in all the headlines. Mm. But I mean, Latvia has had a particular problem over probably the last decade, and there have been lots of high-profile cases involving Latvian banks, money laundering, Magnitsky case, cases linked to Ukraine, even linked to taking assets to North Korea for the nuclear program. So do you think that perhaps this is what the Latvian side is looking to put right, that there's been considerable reputational damage in the Latvian banking sector, and maybe you can help turn that around?
Well, I think it's right to say, and certainly no secret, that there's been reputational damage because of those cases. And to turn it around, I believe, is the government's policy. And that's manifested in the laws that now exist here. In terms of ACAMS, yes, what little role we can play effectively in helping the financial institutions to build a better anti-money laundering system, then we will do that. But reputation is a vital commodity. What did Warren Buffett say? That it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and 5 minutes to lose it. And if you lose it, it takes a long time to get it back. But I'm glad to see and say that from what I've seen so far, short visit, is that the government is very much supportive of improving previously poor perception in this area. And the financial institutions want for various reasons, one of which of course is a legitimate profit-making one, to have a banking system that's attractive to legitimate funds and unattractive to non-legitimate funds.
And are there any sort of parallel cases, maybe other countries, where there's been a similar reputational problem and you've been able to help this turnaround, or at least to improve relationships between banks, say, or between regulator and banks?
Yes, well, I wouldn't want to say that ACAMS is the solution to all problems because it is a private organisation. It's not a government body. So the responsibility for anti-money laundering rests largely with the institutions and the governments themselves. But yes, I think it would be true to say that in all of the, I think, 60 countries that ACAMS has a presence in, we've benefited those. I've come back from Hong Kong recently, where there's a very big chapter in operation, in Singapore, in Canada. And I think that from the perspective of acquainting people with what's happening outside their country is very important. You asked me whether there were other countries who might be in a similar type of position. Yeah, there are a number. I mean, for instance, Cyprus had a perception, and maybe some of that perception still lasts. They've been trying to clean up the act, so to speak, for a couple of years now. And I see that ACAMS has had a role in helping the financial institutions' compliance officers understand what their responsibilities are. So I think there's a parallel there.
I mean, what are the actual obligations beholden to members? Is it just a case of you get them talking to each other, or are you delivering training? Are there rules? Can you be kicked out as a member?
It's not just networking. That's one big plus. It's also the certification means training, being qualified in a particular area of anti-money laundering, whether that be international sanctions work, whether it be anti-fraud and money laundering, whether it be certain areas of forensic accounting. There are a number of qualifications that ACAMS provides, and it's become the certification of choice at the primary level for large financial institutions around the world. I mean, there's nothing that comes close to that membership number, and that's growing at a rapid pace every month, in fact. So ACAMS provides essentially two services. One is training and certification of people to a particular degree, which assists not only their institution, but also helps them in finding employment. We've done a survey not so long ago that shows that compliance officers who have CAMS, as we call it, CAMS certification, CAMS, they are more likely to find work and more likely to get paid more as a consequence. So that's indicative of the necessity to have compliance officers who are well trained.
And I was perusing your CV and some of the incredibly lengthy experience that you've had in not only anti-money laundering, but sort of combating smuggling and various other forms of nastiness. I was just wondering, with anti-money laundering, is it a case that it's sort of the same old scams dressed up in new clothes, or are there constant, is it evolving into completely new sort of ways of laundering? I mean, if you could just give us a sort of brief overview of maybe the most common or the most extreme forms that it can take.
Well, unfortunately, it's both of those things. Some of the traditional methods of money laundering are still rife, whether it be through casinos, whether it be through offshore financial centres. If it's illegal money, I'm not talking about offshore centres for tax or other reasons. But criminal usage, and even the use of cash has come back. Cash was out of favour because, for money launderers at least, for some years, because it was more easily detected, and it was difficult in terms of volume. Like if you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in the U.S. and South America examples, then that's difficult to deal with. Easier to deal with it on an electronic basis of exchange. But it's backed because the methods of detecting other money laundering methods have improved. So, on the other hand, of course, there are many new methods. I mean, it's a matter of creative criminality, really. Criminals, especially organized crime, who have available to them a lot of resources to buy good advice and services, they will use whatever's available to them, including the dark web, including IT solutions, including other ways to hide and disguise money that arises from criminal behavior. So I have to say, I think that law enforcement and regulators are not always able to be in a proactive situation. Some of it is catch-up because you're not quite sure what the criminals are going to be able to use next. And that's why it's so important to keep compliance officers and law enforcement officers up to date on what's happening around the world. That's one of the reasons why we were here.
I was wondering how important as well, I mean, in a way it's a rather obvious answer, but the question of coordination with law enforcement and with the court system in particular is, do you have any specific recommendations on that? Because the Latvian legal system has a reputation for, you know, being quite clean, but being extremely slow in processing cases, which can take, you know, years and years and years. And does that enable money laundering in a greater way? Maybe if people think they can just keep the clock ticking and while the money's rolling in.
I think criminals will make use of whatever advantage they have. And if there is a slow system in terms of detection or prevention or prosecution, then that will be an attraction to use a place for money laundering. But I think the other side of the coin is that you asked about the relationship between law enforcement and financial institutions, for example. The need for closer cooperation is essential. One of the things we've been talking about here today with both government and the private sector is the need for what's often called in around the world public-private partnerships. What that means in practice is that financial institutions have responsibilities under the law to report suspicious or illegal transactions to a government agency, in this case the Financial Intelligence Unit. But around the world the trend now is to try to include financial institutions in more than just reporting what they think is suspicious, but rather to cooperate on a proactive basis. Under the law, you have to have protections under the law to share information. And that sharing of information is essential because information is the lifeblood of investigations or detection of crime. So what we mean by public-private partnerships is that you don't just tick the box of, as a bank, for instance, of reporting what you think is suspicious, and that's difficult enough, but you also, in future, will need to work more closely and more proactively with the government agencies that are responsible for detection and prevention. For example, in the UK, the US, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, public-private partnerships have been set up on a legal grounding whereby financial institution staff on a confidentiality vetted way. In other words, there are protections of confidentiality upon them to work together with government agencies and law enforcement agencies when a crime has actually been committed and there is reason to follow up the financial investigation side. So, in other words, putting both sides more closely together, because you can't expect law enforcement to replicate the level of information and understanding of customers that a bank has, for example, because it's their clients.
Yeah. Is it also incumbent upon the banks to give a certain amount of freedom to their employees in terms of whistleblowing or reporting financial transactions? Because it often seems, in the Latvian context, but not only in the Latvian context, that certain people, maybe lower down ranking people within banks, have known that things are going on, but they've either felt that they don't have the power to report this, or that if they do report it, they will get into more trouble than it would be worth.
Yes. Well, whistleblowing is another aspect of crime work. I think that there are systems in place that determine what banks need to do to report suspicious transactions. That's a systemically embedded system, and the law requires that, and financial institutions must do it, and if they don't do it, there are repercussions and consequences. So that's what should happen and happens in practice all around the world. Whistleblowing, though, is not directly related to that issue or that question, but rather whether an employee of a company or a financial institution or a government agency, for that matter, has noticed something that they believe is a crime or, in fact, is a crime. Mm. And should they report that, and should they be protected from consequences for reporting it themselves? Absolutely. That's the generally accepted principle around the world. Unfortunately, sometimes whistleblowers suffer from consequences for having done that, and it militates against whistleblowing. So the important, to your question, the important ingredient, I think, in terms of whistleblowing is that in order to encourage the detection of whatever crime, I'm not now talking about the anti-money laundering rules, mm-hmm. but rather in general, to encourage whistleblowing is not something that you should leave people in the dark about, or unprotected, or even with them suffering consequences for throwing their colleagues under a bus, mm. for example. But rather that if they have the social sense of responsibility or duty and everyone actually has under the law in most countries a duty to report crime, why should they suffer? On the contrary, they should be protected. So organizations that have whistleblower policies and countries that have whistleblower legislation need to have that work as well in practice as it does on the books.
In the Latvian context, there's one rather special condition which is no secret, that there's effectively two parallel banking sectors, or there have been, one the major retail banks and the other the boutique banks, which are catering largely to money from Russia and former CIS countries. It seems an established fact that this presents a particular problem to Latvia. Your experience elsewhere, does that suggest any particularly effective ways of stopping illicit flows from Russia and further east?
Well, I think that raises the question of what is money flowing for, not just from whom and to whom, which banks need to know about, but for what purpose. So, for example, in a number of countries where legislation or practices have not been up to world standard, and where there is an attractive reason to use a particular jurisdiction for money coming through as a conduit, not necessarily stopping in the country, but coming in and going out fairly quickly. One has to ask questions about why would that happen? Why would that be necessary? It might be necessary for criminal purposes. It might be necessary to have an easy way to, for example, enter the Eurozone, for instance. There might be a number of reasons for that. So those questions, therefore, need to be asked. What's the purpose of the transactions? Are they based on, as the European Union would say in its legislation, is there a legitimate purpose behind it? If not, some further questions need to be asked. So if it were a situation where a country's financial system or part of it were being used just to siphon money from one place to another with no particular legitimate purpose to it, then suspicions would naturally arise. And that would add to two things, I think. One is a reputational risk. The other is whether the legislation and the policies need to kick in to report transactions that come through such a system if there is suspicion attached to them. So this happens in many countries around the world, actually. And that's why anti-money laundering policies and laws have to be of a similar nature around the world, because borders are meaningless these days in terms of money movement and the speed of money movement. So if you have a weak link, it will be exploited. And I'll stop there.
Well, ACAMS is coming here and helping share its expertise, but are you expecting in return to get specific experience from Latvian banks that might help in other chapters in other parts of the world?
To a degree, yes. The main purpose is to set up, as I mentioned before, a grouping of people with similar responsibilities, maybe different experiences, and to improve their own capacities. Second, to offer certification and training. But in terms of what might help with other countries, for example, this Baltics chapter that's going to be launched in an hour or so, that has three countries obviously involved in it, and the principle behind that would be that they have very common challenges, many common challenges at least, and they will help each other. Secondly, across the world, it is interesting to note the challenges that are faced by compliance officers and financial institutions in meeting their responsibilities. So yes, it is true to say that ACAMS it's not an investigation agency, it's a private organisation that provides certification and training and assistance. But on the other hand, it is a community of people, of compliance officers, all with the same basic job and duty. And therefore, while, for instance, you might have different challenges in different places, like, for instance, as I mentioned, I was recently in Hong Kong, there are issues there which are not too dissimilar to some issues here as to money coming and going. It's a major financial centre, as you'd expect. On the other hand, there are more unique features of each country which are only applicable to it. So, but where there's an overlap, where there are lessons to learn, yes, through ACAMS, that can be used, that information or that knowledge and that experience can be used to help each other. And we do that by means of large and small size conferences. On an annual basis, ACAMS probably put on 50 to 100 conferences, some of them gigantic, with 2,600 people down to about 100 or so. So this exchange of typologies, if I can use that term, in other words, examples of how money is being laundered, the challenges that are faced and solutions being offered by how to handle issues such as sanctions. You're familiar with international UN sanctions, US sanctions against particular individuals or entities or countries, and how you actually implement those requirements. It always helps in the professional life to compare what you do with what somebody else has done. You can learn good or bad lessons.
There's a kind of an explosion happening within financial services at the moment, the fintech companies, virtual currencies. Do you have relationships or influence in these sectors as well? Because I noticed that today, I mean, you have the major banks here, you have the finance ministry, all sort of long established and familiar faces. But is it incumbent upon you now to also reach out to, you know, fintech startups, people like that, to try and get some sort of coordinated anti-money laundering system there?
It's very important to do that because banking and the movement of funds is rapidly changing. In fact, some experts on the financial side, as opposed to on the crime side, would say that what banking looks like today is not going to be what banking looks like in 3 years from now. You know, Google or Apple or Amazon or others will be moving funds, and are beginning to do now, quite legitimately, in a very rapid and reliable and presumably competitive cost basis that's attractive. So that is a changing dynamic. So the processes that have been put in place over the years that apply to traditional banking and how you detect suspicious transactions may have to change and change quickly or evolve quickly. Like in ACAMS, for example, when we have conferences, especially the large ones, we always have large fintech organizations come. In fact, on the board of the advisory board of ACAMS now, we have some of those companies represented for that very reason, that they can give insight into how money is being moved through their services, including telecom services, for instance. I mean, in Africa, it's a good example where there's been a quantum leap from limited services to money being transacted by a peer-to-peer mobile phone, M-Pesa, for instance, in Kenya, which has picked up huge business and has helped the people enormously because you can pay your debts or you can pay your costs and move money rapidly and easily. While that brings a lot of benefit to the economy and to people's lives, there are also risks there. And with money laundering, the issue is always not just the crime involved, but the anonymity. How do you detect who's sending the money and who's receiving the money? So you need to have a system in place that can detect who put it into the system, whatever system you're talking about, and who received it at the other end. And that's why the new technologies are not only important, but are significant challenges to that anonymity question.
And just to wrap up, I mean, as a non-specialist, it can seem quite confusing or puzzling looking at money laundering at the moment, in that it seems that we get more and more cases reported of bigger and bigger sums. Is this a case that there is more and more money laundering happening on a grander and grander scale and more people are getting away with it? Or are we detecting more and recovering more? Because I guess it's a kind of glass half full, glass half empty situation, but you have lengthy experience. What's your general take on the trend?
My general take on the trend is that there is more of it happening. It's true to say that, like all law enforcement efforts in the past, you can't detect all crime. I mean, no police force, for example, anywhere in the world could have 100% success. Otherwise, there'd be no crime, and crime is very popular with some people. But that being said, the ease at which money is transferable and movable across borders. As I said, borders are irrelevant now. And the size of the profits that can be made from organized crime is absolutely huge, and it's growing. And that's a game changer in terms of what mechanisms governments have to put in place and keep on top of. So the level of organized crime is increasing, the amount of money being laundered is increasing, and this is in fact factually determinable too, because the UN Office on Drugs and Crime put out a study about 2 years ago giving a ballpark or a rough estimate on their expertise about how much money is being laundered around the world, and they reiterated a figure that the IMF came up with many years ago, which is at least 2% of global GDP. That's a lot of money. We're talking about trillions of dollars from all sorts of crime being laundered, hidden, and misused. And of course, the society misses out on taxes. Corrupt individuals get away with it. Crime is not diminished. On the contrary, so it's a profit motive game, and the amount of profits available are increasing. I mean, just to give you one little example, which usually is interesting for people, I've been doing some work with sports organizations. Most people in the world like sports. Sports came from clubs and trusted relationships and was amateur. These days in the large sporting fields, such as football, world football, but not just there, cricket and other sports as well, the amounts of money available for betting, for instance, and club ownership and transfer fees and whatever. There's an attraction because of the size of the money involved, the amount of money involved, for criminals to try to get their hands on it. And in another piece of work I've been doing, we're trying to put standards in place in relation to sports governance and sports betting. That all also comes back to good governance in sport, as it does to good governance in any organisation. And why, to your question again, is there more of it happening? Yes, there's more of it happening wherever there are larger and larger amounts of money to be made.